keeping the COVID inquiry honest, it's time for the inquiry sessions. My name is Alistair Harding, and today we have back with us on the inquiry sessions, Jody Brunning, to talk with us about how the COVID era's laws were made. And make no mistake, what you're about to hear may at first sound very complicated. But once it's explained, it is an extraordinary tale that history will either see as a departure from democracy for our nation, or the point when we discovered why we fell in love with that system of government in the first place. Jody Brunning is a sociologist and trustee for Physicians and Scientists for Global Responsibility, who spent her pandemic researching and sending off official Information Act requests and writing articles for the likes of the Brownstone Institute, as she attempted to unravel and understand how the wheels of government turned during that unprecedented period. And so today she's going to share with us some of what she learned of how the laws were made in secret and passed while we were locked in our homes sleeping, and how today, despite the so-called emergency period being over, those wheels of government continue to turn in much the same way. So Jody, welcome to the inquiry sessions. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Alistair. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so if we're talking about how laws were passed during the COVID period, let's start with how they're passed in normal times. What's the basic process? I know you're not a lawyer, but step by step, how are they passed in the simplest terms you can muster?
Right. So thank you for specifying that I'm not a lawyer. And I would love any lawyers, particularly lawyers working in constitutional and administrative law, to come on and to talk about all the things that we're talking about today, including how law should be made in a working democracy. So thank you for that. So a minister will, you know, there will be a policy that's approved. And the minister will then, and the cabinet will approve that policy, and the department will prepare the drafting instructions, and they get sent to the Parliamentary Council Office, the PCO, and they draft lots of versions, and they go through all those versions, then, you know, a public exposure draft sent out, and then final comments, they get approval, and then the review, you know, you get a bill of rights. So this is all on the Parliamentary Council website, that they get a Bill of Rights Act vet. And then the PCO does final proofreading and edits. And then, you know, the bill is introduced. There is the first reading. And then the bill can go to select committee. But before select committee, the bill is released and for public consultation, the public can come back and comment on the bill. And then it goes through, you know, the second and third readings, and then it gets passed, and then it gets royal assent. And then that becomes an act of law, an empowering legislation that gives the government ministers and the officials working under that particular act powers to work under that act.
Okay. So when we entered the COVID period, we were all told that this was an extraordinary period that required extraordinary powers and processes. We were told that our nation's safety was at stake. And for many, the fear that was engendered made most of us go along with it. And there was a sense of urgency and history about the whole thing. So new laws were needed. And there was one particular law that was passed first. This is the empowering law, isn't it? What was that law and what did it say?
So that's the COVID-19 Public Health Response Act 2020. That was a 13th of May, one day piece of legislation. It was proposed, put there by the Attorney General, David Parker. And that bill, that the core aims of that bill were to, you know, set in place and to manage the COVID response. So a good way to look at that is to look up that actual bill and look up the purposes of that bill. So every bill has, that becomes an act, and every act has a purpose. And so that's sort of meant to give the officials the overriding aims of that bill. So that was to prevent and limit the risk of the outbreak or spread of COVID-19, because, of course, we weren't this is part of the problem that I have seen from the very start. Pandemic status did not necessarily have to mean hospitalisation and death. So this is part of that obsession about case numbers. So it was the risk or spread of COVID-19. It was avoiding, mitigating, or remedying the actual potential adverse effects of a COVID-19 outbreak, which is people becoming ill. It had to be coordinated, orderly, and proportionate. It had to allow social, economic, and other factors to be taken into account. It had to be economically sustainable and allow for the recovery of MIQ costs. And it had could have enforceable measures in addition to the relevant voluntary measures and public health and other guidance. So that was the purpose of that first overnight act that was theoretically meant to engender a proportionate response to SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19.
Okay. So that was what was called the COVID-19 Public Health Response Act 2020, and that was passed in early May 2020. There were then two amendments to that bill. The first came later in 2020, and the second amendment was made between August and November 2021. And that's the amendment we're going to focus on for the moment, just to understand what happened next.
Yes.
Tell us about that bill, that amendment bill, what it said, and then we'll deal with how it passed through Parliament and what sort of reaction it got. What did the amendment, the second amendment, contain, and how did it pass through Parliament?
So this amendment, and you can look this up in very clearly in the select committee discussion on this bill. And so it was to extend the expiry date of the Act to May 2023. It was to improve the flexibility for making the COVID-19 orders. So we can talk about the COVID-19, the orders in council in a little bit. It was to strengthen the infringement regime and deter non-compliance with orders. It was to support the effective management and operation of managed isolation and quarantine, the MIQ facilities, and it was to enable a limited group of enforcement officers to stop vehicles at checkpoints. So that's those 5 points were the foundation of this amendment bill number two.
And how was it greeted? Did it received submissions on this, didn't it? How was that greeted in the process of it being passed?
Yes. So remember, just to put a little bit of perspective, so we already had mandates coming out as orders in council, as secondary legislation from April 28th, 2021. So this was for the border workers, the port workers, the airline workers. These people were already being mandated through the orders in council. So then, and because remember in March 2021, Jacinda had purchased enough vaccines for the entire country.
Sorry, could I just interrupt for 1 second, Jody? So I think right at this point we should explain. What is secondary legislation?
So the primary act is called an empowering act. And we can, so what that necessitates is going through that slow process that we already talked about through Parliament or the consultation. Secondary legislation, also known as delegated legislation, can be what's called an order in council. And how an order in council can be produced is that a minister will get an idea and go to cabinet, and the cabinet meeting for this could involve, I'm afraid, as little as three ministers. And I'd hate to think that it was only two ministers, but three ministers is plausible. And they convene to agree on the order in council, and that goes to the Parliamentary Council Office for drafting, and they do all the secret drafting. And it is secret. I tried to do an Official Information Act request to understand when a particular agreement for an order in council was signed off by cabinet, and they won't tell me, and neither will the Parliamentary Council Office. No one will divulge. So you know, this is part of the whole cabinet secrecy, but I think it, I do believe it's been gamed. So this was how all the orders and councils, this is how the MIQ workers and then all the different workers through all the different schedules of different people were, it was rolled out to flexibly without having to go through Parliament.
Okay, so that's really important. That's how they introduced the mandates without actually having to go through a submission process.
Yes. And if I could just add one thing. So if you look at government documents on all the rules, there's a document called the Legislation Design and Advisory Committee document. And so in this, they used to be called LACs, they're called LADCs in the 2021 one and the one before. Section 7 of NZ Borah is of special relevance to the development of legislation, and it requires the Attorney General, upon the introduction of a government bill, to bring to the attention of the House of Representatives any provision that he or she considers to be inconsistent with the rights or freedom, a right or freedom in Borah. Now, if we think about secondary legislation, the delegated legislation, the orders in council, as a general rule, matters of significant policy and principle should be included in an act. And so secondary legislation should only deal with minor or technical matters. And some matters, this is in these guidelines, such as those that affect fundamental human rights in a significant way, are clearly appropriate only for an act. So that's in these guidelines. So I'm just leaving, you know, you with that thought before we go back to where we were.
Here we are. We've got the COVID Response Act, and that hasn't mentioned mandates, but then the mandates are introduced through secondary legislation.
Mm-hmm.
Don't have to go through the process that you outlined at the very beginning. It doesn't have to be subject to submissions from the public. Is that correct? Is that my understanding?
That's correct. So we haven't, so we weren't permitted in that first act to make any comment. The orders in council come out. We're not making any comments. So the first time we're really able to make a comment on all of this is with this COVID-19 Amendment Bill number 2. It was introduced on the 21st of August. Now, on the 14th of September, the Attorney General stated that this amendment bill would not impact the rights and freedoms of New Zealanders. So he's doing his job there. But of course, this one doesn't mention vaccines or mandates. It doesn't talk about that. So on the 30th of September, 2021, the submission opens for public consultation. The first time we get to feedback, the public are given only 10 days. And in that 10 days, nearly 15,000 people respond. The submissions closed on October the 11th. By October the 15th, Liz Craig and the Parliamentary Select Committee are hearing oral submissions. The Select Committee is broken in two to efficiently process us all. And by the end of October, a thoughtful departmental report had been prepared by the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment, discussing, providing advice to help deal with those 15,000 people that had submitted. And it noted that people were concerned about vaccine mandates. Then we have the November 11th, 10 days later, Select Committee report comes. There's only the National Party makes some comments on vaccination, we can see in this Select Committee report, but not a single member of the public, not a single discussion is undertaken of the extent to which there was controversy, to which the public were concerned ethically, morally, physically about what the implications of this new amendment bill meant. Now, in this department report, they said, right, 15,000 people have responded, but oh gosh, 14,000 people of those have not spoken to the substance of the bill, because in that actual number 2 bill, we never talked about vaccinations. And those people are talking about vaccinations. So they're out of scope. So we're not really going to think about them.
So 14,000 submissions were ignored because they spoke about vaccinations And this bill wasn't about this amendment bill was not about vaccinations. That's how they got the voices of New Zealanders who were concerned about vaccinations out of the discussion.
Yes. So we've seen this in other processes as well. So it's not just COVID that we're seeing this model. So remember the 5 points that we already talked about? None of those 5 points included vaccinations. They said improving the flexibility for making COVID-19 orders. That's what they said.
Yes. It was the first time through this whole COVID-19 response bill process since the beginning that New Zealanders had been given the opportunity to voice their views on this.
Yes. Exactly. And remember, the Attorney General said it would not impact the rights and freedoms of New Zealanders because, of course, we're not talking about vaccinations in this bill, are we?
Okay. So what happened next? When did the Second Amendment to the COVID Response Bill reach royal assent?
Okay, that was on the November the 19th. It was given royal assent. So no mention of vaccine certificates, no mention of vaccines.
And then the very next day, they do start to mention it. This is extraordinary. They've obviously planned this. We've got the COVID-19 Public Health Response Act done. We've had the two amendments done. It's all in place. New Zealanders now have no choice but to comply. But vaccines and mandates and passports, all the mechanisms of the vaccine mandates, they suddenly pop up for the public the very next day when on November 20, Chris Hipkins introduces a new bill. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So this is where it's confusing. This next day, the 20th of November, Hipkins actually introduced, it's not a bill, it's a COVID public health response vaccinations order. So he was, the whole time, he is submitting, the public are coming back, he is drafting a secret order in council mentioning vaccines 320 times. That comes through. Remember, it doesn't have to go through Parliament on the one day later. This is when the certificates are introduced. This is a smaller bill. It's 8,000 words. It passes the first reading, the select committee, the second reading, the committee of the whole house, the third reading, all in one day. Now, this is a bill that becomes integrated into that act. There was no regulatory state impact statement that the public were ever seen, and there was no Attorney General comment on whether it infringed the Bill of Rights. The bill comment stated that the amendments in this omnibus bill, which addresses a lot of stuff, make vaccination a more prominent part of New Zealand's COVID-19 response framework.
Where was the Attorney General in all of this? Why wasn't he having to make a statement about the Bill of Rights in this particular event?
Well, I've looked up Hansard to see, and I can't see even him talking. Like, you know, I can't see him in Parliament making any comments in the first reading. He's gone missing. I don't know.
Because we obviously know what the thoughts of New Zealanders are. We've just had 15,000 submissions talking about how vaccine mandates would be trampling on our Bill of Rights. They already know that. They've written a report about that.
Exactly. And can we just go back to that departmental report, which was the tool that the government used to dismiss 14,000 people? And I think it helps when people understand the words the government uses. So in the MOH and MB departmental report in October, they said approximately 14,000 remaining submissions did not relate directly to the legislative changes proposed in the bill, but reflected deeply held concerns by some parts of the community around the government's response to COVID-19. These submitters were particularly concerned with vaccination and the government's management of the current COVID-19 outbreak, including comments on the mandatory isolation of COVID-19 cases. There were also many submissions which raised concerns broadly about human rights and the consistency of the Act with the NZ Borer, but did not address any specific element of the bill. Many submitters expressed concerns that government would have an unfettered ability to require mandatory vaccination, detain the unvaccinated, subject people to compulsory medical testing, examination, or experimentation, or otherwise infringe their human rights without justification. A significant number of submissions referenced oppressive governments of the past. Officials note that consultation on this bill coincides with a point in time where vaccination is at the centre of the government's response to COVID-19. While officials acknowledge the genuine fears and concerns expressed by submitters, so remember, these are officials in MOH and MBIE, not in Parliament. Our role as advisors to the committee is to assist the committee in its consideration of the bill. The remainder of this report, therefore, will focus on the minority of submissions, around 1,000, which related directly to the bill itself, and especially those in which submitters made specific recommendations to improve the bill. So, in one page, those two departments working together on this report dismissed 14,000 people.
Let's also put this in context. Let's put this in context also at the time, because many of us forget. I mean, this is the genius of how these politicians and the bureaucrats did this. They did things at such speed to shock and awe us so that we had no time to think. But I went back and I reminded myself by looking at the news reports of the time, and there's the New Zealand Herald wrote about this act being pushed through in one day, calling it contemptuous lawmaking. And that was actually a quote from Chris Bishop, the national COVID-19 spokesman. He said this, and I quote, "This is contemptuous of Parliament, contemptuous of the people of New Zealand, contemptuous of the rule of law." And the story went on to say that Chris Bishop feared the secretive and non-transparent way the bill was being rammed through that could fuel division. And he said, "This bill will backfire on the government. It will not help." But it wasn't just him. There was also a quote there from Te Pāti Māori co-leader Debbie Narewa Packer. And she said that it was a cruel bill that tramples on tikanga. And here they are, they're saying, oh, this is secretive and non-transparent, and this is contemptuous of the rule of law. But then that's it. I mean, we're talking about a situation like just recently where Christopher Luxon was being grilled over his apartment allowance for days on end until he finally gave it away. But in this particular case, this contemptuous of the rule of law Act of Parliament was hardly discussed at all. It was discussed for one day and then it was on to where's your passport?
Yes. So this comes back to the fact that the people, and Sir Geoffrey Palmer has talked about this, the ministries have the money and they have the power and they have the resources. So the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment were the people that managed the information. Remember, it was MBIE that signed the vaccines agreement. It was MOH that signed the, you know, that they worked together to sign the vaccines agreement. They were the people that had the biggest political interest in the vaccines rollout, that for the vaccines that were purchased for the whole of New Zealand. They were the last people that should have been analysing this information. And so this is what Sir Geoffrey Palmer has talked about this. He's said in a recent interview, I think on Stuff, that that you have these laws that are being proposed and then you have the consultation process, but the actual ministries that have the vested interest in the outcome are the ones that are analysing the public content, the public comment. This is a breakdown of parliamentary process. And so when we think about the COVID-19 inquiry, we need to understand how the processes were broken. We need to understand how, for this vaccinations bill, there was no regulatory impact assessment. There was no Borer, NZ Borer Act. We need to understand that for the entire process of Hipkins or all the work that these officials were doing, putting through these orders, They were never looking at this, what the scientific literature was saying about safety and efficacy. They were never looking at age-related risk. And so what Bishop said was, he said the traffic light framework, when it went to cabinet on the Monday preceding the Friday announcement, had had no consultation done by the Ministry of Justice officials. How disgraceful, he said. And if you doubt that this bill has New Zealand Bill of Rights implications, just read the legal advice, because it impacts at least eight. You could probably think of more. Dr. Dean Knight of Victoria University said it was a constitutional disgrace. The Human Rights Commission criticised it. The Council of Civil Liberties criticised the speed with which it was being passed. And Debbie Ngarawera-Packer said, it's Enhancer, it's not compliant with Te Tiriti.
Okay, so where were these people in February 2022, only a couple of months later, when the people of New Zealand turned up to the front lawn of Parliament to protest those exact points? They were protesting the mandates. We've got them on record saying that it was contemptuous of the New Zealand public. Where were they then?
I just can only consider that they weren't sleeping well, and that the cognitive dissonance. Remember, they were not Labor. Labor had the majority. So, but they should have been active advocates, and they should have continued speaking out. And if they had only looked at the submissions, even the oral submissions to the Amendment Bill number two, to see the extent to which the vaccine was neither safe or effective. If they had only had access, because of course our science system is broken, we did not have any funding for anyone to review the literature. It was all about the modelling. It was all about what Pfizer would report, what Pfizer cared to disclose, frankly. So the parliamentary officials were sort of, they were dependent on the Ministry of Health, who had the conflict of interest in the outcome. So this is what the COVID-19 inquiry, people need to really be asking the commissioners to look at process, at the new commissioners, because we shouldn't be having the current commissioners to look at this process.
So to sum up what we've seen here, the use of passing laws with that majority that Labor had at the time, let's not forget that. And then the use of secondary legislation, orders in council, these amendments, this sort of twisting of words so that you don't have to take submissions from, you can discard 14,000 submissions from the public about vaccines, because that particular amendment doesn't speak about it, but then don't have submissions when it comes to talking about that particular topic. These are the wheels, these are the levers that were used throughout. So let's sum this up. The final question: what's the legacy to all of this?
The legacy is that Hipkins is probably the most unconscionable minister that we've seen in 20 plus years, in putting through the number two act, in then putting in that immediate order the day after, then in putting in the Vaccinations Act, and then the next order. I mean, he was working, I believe, with Verrill and Woods. I wonder where Parker was, but it is Hipkins that has, in his newly, they invented the Minister of COVID-19. The Minister for COVID-19 was invented for all of this process. So we have to understand, the minute he moved out of his ministerial portfolio, I can't make an Official Information Act request. So this is another problem that we have. We need to actually stop that happening.
Explain that again. That's really important. Now he's not the COVID-19 response minister. You can't
Yes.
ask for any Official Information Act requests from his time in that role. Yeah.
No, it's extraordinarily sort of impossible. I can't find out what his thinking was, what his decision making was, what the science and information. I mean, I know it wasn't he, because of all the other work I was doing. I know he wasn't actually looking at any science on the safety and efficacy, because we have to look back. As a final thought, we have to look back to April. March and April 2021, and there was this triangle of how it would roll out. It would roll out through all the different stages, and then this last part of the rollout would be the general public, and then everyone would be vaccinated. So we can go back and we look at Philip Joseph's work on administrative and constitutional law. We can ask, what is impartial? What is fair? We can ask, was there a degree of predetermination here? We can say, did the officials look at all the mandatory relevant considerations? Did they think about age stratified risk? Did they think about a healthy 18-year-old or a healthy 20-year-old, a healthy 40-year-old getting a vaccine for a genetic therapy, a gene-based therapy? So we have to understand that this was a brand new technology that for 20 years before 2021 was shown to be harmful. And we had none of this consideration by the officials rolling this out. And so I'd like to thank RCR for interviewing me, because I have written thousands of words on this, and it's all cited with links to the parent legislation, the secondary legislation. I haven't had a single mainstream media journalist approach me to talk about this. They simply do not want to talk about anything that contradicts the government.
And now we're not going to know the inner workings of it, because Chris Hipkins is no longer the COVID-19 response minister, and you can't even ask about that anymore.
No, I mean, there is the discovery process, and we can only hope that the COVID-19 inquiry will pull out more and more information. And look, the existing Official Information Act responses that we've already seen provide a compelling and condemning sort of image or story that we already understand of sort of obfuscation of the truth and a failure to look at inconvenient facts.
Jody, thank you very much for your work on this. It's an extremely complicated subject, but it's so important if we're actually going to learn anything out of what we've gone through over the last few years. And it's so eye-opening. And lastly, I suppose, I hope it's heard by someone. I hope it's heard by people around this country. And maybe, as we've mentioned in this interview, maybe some lawyers and legal minds can pick this up and actually make sure that these things don't happen again, no matter how well-meaning they are.
Thank you so much, Alistair. Look, I'll get this put up on PSGR, PSGRNZ, our Substack. So if you do psgrnz.substack.com, that will take you to what we've talked about today with the links, but that might take maybe three or four days to get that up anyway.
That's Jody Brunning, sociologist and trustee for Physicians and Scientists for Global Responsibility, talking to us today about what she learned about how the laws of the COVID era were passed here in New Zealand, without the due process we expect from our politicians. Even if you agree with all that went on in the COVID era, if you love democracy, what you heard here today should chill you to the bone. The rules of lawmaking are in place to ensure we don't have situations arise when the voices of the people are not heard. That's what the submissions process is for. And two, those rules are in place to ensure that our basic rights and freedoms are respected. That's why there's a requirement to measure legislation against the Bill of Rights. Neither should we ever be subjected to laws that have gone through in secret under the cloak of secondary legislation. Yet in the COVID era, all those things were done. In essence, this interview is a challenge to the lawyers and lawmakers and the judges of this country to finally speak up and ensure this not only never happens again, but it is written into law with all due process that it cannot happen again. My name is Alistair Harding, and you've been listening to the Inquiry Sessions only on Reality Check Radio.
The RCR Inquiry Sessions. Unpacking the COVID response for an honest inquiry.